Welcome to the 11KBW podcast, an education law update by Peter Oldham QC and Rachel Cam. This talk was given at the 11KBW Local Authority Conference on the 4th of October 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Schools and religion, and the purpose of this talk is to draw together some of the current strands when we think about religious rights in schools. And I think the reason for doing that is that these rights are rather disparately expressed in our law, and it's not easy to keep an eye on them all and just to keep a general picture in one's mind of where these sources of rights and duties in relation to religion at schools come from and what they're doing. And the first point to note is that when we talk about religious rights, religious duties in schools, we're also talking about no religion, because belief and disbelief are accorded many similar rights in our law, and that's the effect of both Section 10 of the Equality Act 2010, which defines belief, religious belief, as including a lack of belief, and also the effect of the relevant parts of the ECHR and the ones that normally crop up, the articles that normally crop up when one's talking about religious beliefs at school at any rate, are Article 9 and to an extent Article 10 and sometimes Article 2 of Protocol 1 combined or not combined with Article 14. Article 8, right to privacy, is rather dropped off the radar as far as religion is concerned, largely because these other rights, in particular Article 9, are generally thought to do the trick, or at least not to take Article 8 won't generally take matters much further. The case law is mainly, as I say, about believers, but that's not always the case. There's a case called Fox against the Secretary of State for Education. And I think this is quite an important case given the latest announcement from the government suggesting that it's going to allow a pretty free development of further religious schools to meet demand. In the light of that, there may well be further challenges from secularists. This was one of them, the Fox case. The DfE gave guidance to awarding organisations for the content of religious studies GCSEs, and the challenge was that the guidance from the Secretary of State was misleading because it provided scope for awarding organisations to develop syllabuses without giving proper weight to non-religious beliefs. And the guidance, it was said, was therefore wrong to say, as it did, that such a syllabus would discharge the state's RE duties during Key Stage 4. And the argument was that somewhere along the line in Key Stage 4, pupils had to learn about non-religious beliefs, even if it wasn't part of the RE syllabus for this GCSE. And the court agreed with that and said, to that extent, the Secretary of State's guidance saying that this GCSE will fulfil the state's duties was not correct. OK, so sources of rights and duties in this field. And I've divided these into the situation before you actually get to a school and the situation once you're at a school. So first of all, choice of school and admission. What are the sources of rights and duties here? Well, first of all, we have Section 9 of the 1996 Act, which, as you'll recall, imposes a duty on the Secretary of State and local authorities in exercising their duties to have regard to the general principle that pupils are to be educated in accordance with the parents' wishes, so far as that's compatible with efficient instruction and training and the avoidance of unreasonable public expenditure. And we know from the old case of Watt and Castephen Borough Council that this isn't an absolute duty, namely that even if those two conditions are fulfilled, the local authority isn't bound then to send the child or to allow the child to attend or to require a third party to get the child to let the child into a school that the parent would prefer. It's a have regard duty, albeit an important one. And then we have Article 2 of Protocol 1 of the ECHR, which in this context provides quite limited rights, so generally won't take the matter past Section 9. Then we have Part 6 of the Equality Act 2010, and this is the duty on all schools, save those with a religious character, not to discriminate on religious grounds on who they admit. And our old friend, the PSED, the Public Sector Equality Duty, that rears its head even here. Easy to overlook. And I think this is possibly of more relevance to faith schools, schools with a religious character, than others, easily overlooked in this context. The reason for my saying that is that although Part 6, the duty not to discriminate on religious grounds, is largely disapplied in the case of such schools, faith schools, Section 149 isn't. So in formulating their admission criteria, it seems to me they have got to bear in mind the duty to have regard to the need to foster good relations between different religious groups, which is one of the Section 149 duties. Now, having done so, having thought about that duty, they may decide that they're not going to open up their admission criteria at all, but that's not to say they shouldn't actually go through that process in the first place. And last, the admissions code, which, as you may recall, says that when adopting faith-based admission criteria, admission authorities have to, with schools within a religious character, must have regard to any guidance from a body representing that religion. So much for rights and duties in relation to admission. What about when you've actually got to school, pupils at school? Well, here I've listed... I suspect it's not the entire list, but what I think are some of the main sources of rights and duties in relation to religion. You've got the curriculum and worship obligations under the 2002 Act and the School Standards and Framework Act 1998. You've again got the Equality Act, Part 6, and Section 149, the PSED. You've got the Convention, Articles 9, Well, 8, to a lesser extent, 9, A2P1, with or without Article 14. Now here, in relation to the convention, the most commonly litigated right has been the right to wear religious clothing and symbols. And I'll come to those in a moment, because I think they're quite a useful reminder of how Article 9 works, generally and particularly in this context. It's not the only situation, though, where Article 9 arises. I've been involved in a case where, for instance, a Muslim child at a community primary school, not a faith school, wanted to say prayers at lunchtime. And the child was of an age when she couldn't be left on her own and so would have to be supervised. But all the staff were either committed during the lunch break or were themselves on their own break. And the school said it couldn't help. Now, the case settled, but the issue was whether there was a lawful interference with the Article 9 right to pray. And we'll come to the sort of balancing approach that the court would have adopted in that case when we look at the clothing and symbols cases. Number four, less directly, so to speak, but exerting an indirect power here, the Ofsted inspection framework, which, as you know, Ofsted produces a great deal of guidance of one sort or another, but it a lot of it refers to equalities, duties, equalities, powers, also fundamental British values, FBVs, which I've referred to there, and I'm going to explore FBVs in a little bit more detail later on. But because the Ofsted inspection framework lays emphasis on equalities, including religious equalities, that's another, as it were, pressure point for schools and local authorities when they're considering religious rights and duties at schools. Independent schools, I know we're not directly concerned with independent schools, but again, looking at fundamental British values, as we'll see, regulations relating to independent schools do tell us what those fundamental British values in fact are. They say they define them, and as we'll see, they are relevant to maintain schools too. So worthwhile keeping an eye on what happens to independent schools as regards fundamental British values. And DfE statutory guidance to schools and childcare providers on the prevent duty. Now the prevent duty, as you know, is the duty under Section 26 of the Counter-Terrorism and Security Act of 2015 to have due regard to the need to prevent people from being drawn into terrorism. So this may affect schools watching out for signs of extremism of any sort, and that in turn, that may tend to terrorism, and that will sometimes include religious extremism. So where are the arenas of legal dispute in this field of schools and religion? Well, they are numerous. Here are some of them. School transport. Is there a duty to transport a child to a faith school even though a community school is nearer? That's an issue that sometimes crops up. Religious clothing and symbols. Come to that in a moment. Challenges to Ofsted reports, which, as I've explained, to a certain extent, police the school's approach to equalities and fundamental British values through its own through their own guidance. Now, Ofsted reports are pretty frequently challenged, actually. One of interest recently, which I've been involved in, was a slightly unusual one, which concerned Ofsted's approach to a faith school's observance of equalities and fundamental British values, and that's known as the ex-school case, no judgment as yet. A bit more information about that later on. Next area of dispute, humanism. We've seen the Fox case, and also here, standing advisory councils on religious education, SACRs, or SACRAs as they're called, are relevant, and the RE syllabus. You'll recall that SACRs are statutory bodies which advise local authorities on matters in connection with religious worship and RE. And I've seen a number of challenges by humanist organisations, generally speaking, to the makeup of SACRs and the advice that they give. So another area where humanism, lack of belief, bears on what we're talking about today. Independent school standards, again, we're not directly involved with those, but as I've explained just now, because they touch on issues of fundamental British values, they are indirectly relevant to what schools do because FBVs are, of course, sorry, maintained schools, because FBVs are relevant to maintained schools too, and indeed academies. Segregation of boys and girls, that's an issue also touched on in the ex-school case. Some maintained faith schools do separate boys and girls either entirely or for part of the day, and that's an issue which the ex-school case touches on. Religion and fundamental British values. Well, fundamental British values is a term that gets bandied about a lot, but what does it mean? Well, it's not in fact defined in any legislation directly applicable to maintained schools or academies, but they are defined in the Independent School Standards Regs of 2014, and we know from them that social, moral, spiritual and cultural development must actively promote, and teaching must not undermine the fundamental British values of democracy, which are listed. They are the rule of law, individual liberty, the fundamental British values are first democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty, and the one we're most involved with just now, mutual respect and tolerance of those with different faiths and beliefs. Now, they're relevant to all schools because of this prevent duty that I've mentioned, because DfE guidance cross-refers to fundamental British values, specifically on the prevent duty and on social, moral, spiritual and cultural development, and the Ofsted guidance that I've referred to. And you will find Ofsted reports referring specifically to FBVs and a school's response to them. Clothing and symbols cases. I mentioned earlier on that this is the bulk of actually the fought cases on Article 9, and they're of interest, as I say, because they show us how Article 9 is applied, and it might be worth just while reminding ourselves of where we've got to there, because there've been one or two developments in the case law, not directly on clothing and symbols, which bear on how we should read these cases in retrospect. The first case, the most important one, the leading case, is Begum and Denbigh High School, and this is a case of a female's pupil wished to wear a jilbab outside the school's uniform policy, and the school said, no, you can't do that. And the issue was whether Article 9 allowed her to do that, or whether Article 9 was engaged at all, and if it was engaged, whether the school's reason for saying she couldn't where this item of clothing was a proportionate means of attaining a legitimate aim, that being those being the battleground, so to speak, that being the battleground under Article 9, and House of Lords held 3-2 that there was no interference with the right at all, because other schools were available for this pupil to go to where she could wear what she wanted to. Now, it's important, I think, we read that in the light of Awada in the UK, an employment case, because that might suggest there's going to be a rather more stringent approach to arguments about alternatives being available. So just one to watch out for there. However, unanimously, the House of Lords held that had there been an interference at all, the interference would have been justified because the school was entitled to have a uniform policy. The uniform policy is very carefully developed and sensitive to the cultural needs of various communities attending the school, so no problem there for the school. And again, as Jonathan Moffat reminded us this morning, one has to slightly keep up with the different ways the proportionality test is expressed in the case law. Perhaps the one that I bear in mind now is the simple fair balance test that perhaps the Supreme Court alit upon in Bank Malat and Treasury, so striking a fair balance. The other clothing and symbols cases, quite interesting because they show things going various ways. The first two were both about a wish to wear the niqab, the full face veil, but the first one was about the pupil's wish to do so, the second about a teacher's wish to do so. In both cases, the claim failed because for various reasons, but not least because ultimately, even if there was an interference, there was justification. Now, justification is terribly fact-sensitive. So whenever you're in Article 9 territory and you're thinking about justification, you as defendant authorities will be wanting to provide the clearest and most detailed evidence possible about exactly why it is that whatever rule is in question is needed. The courts will look at justification defences with considerable stringency. So very important to put your best evidential foot forward in a case like this. Watkins Singh case went the other way. The pupil wanted to wear the Sikh bangle, the kara, and the school said no, but because, and again, coming to justification and the evidence, because on the facts, actually wearing the kara was not going to create any difficulty for anyone, not going to create any health and safety issues because it could be taped to the pupil's wrist during PE and so on, there was no justification on the facts for that interference. And lastly, a case called Playfoot, which interestingly fell at the first hurdle, reminds us of the ambit of Article 9. Pupil wanted to wear a so-called purity ring, and this purity ring was meant to be expressive of a belief in chastity outside marriage from a Christian point of view. But the judge held that this symbol wasn't in fact intimately linked to religious belief at all, unlike, say, a crucifix in Christian terms, so that Article 9 wasn't engaged in the first place. So it's not every assertion of right nominally based on religion that will get through the Article 9 hurdle. A couple more words on that ex-school case before I hand over to Rachel. As I say, this is about a school that separates boys and girls by reason of religious preference. Ofsted report suggested that might have sex discrimination, that division might be sex discriminatory, even though boys and girls were in fact treated equally. A couple of points to note of interest. First of all, this is a rare case where there was an interim injunction preventing publication of the report pending the outcome of the judicial review claim, notwithstanding the rather heightened test, or considerably heightened test, for getting injunctions against bodies such as Ofsted, which have a duty or powers to publish reports in the public interest. In those cases, there's been a line of authority developed based on a case called Rath, where the court says, well, in those cases, it's not just your normal American cyanamide test that you've got to get over. You've got to show, as it was put in an example, Birmingham College and Ofsted, a sort of heightened temperature type situation. And in the X case, there, the court, notwithstanding that test, did say that there should be an interim injunction. The second interesting point arising here is whether there's sex discrimination at all, and there was an interesting attempt to induce some to approach the matter through U.S. jurisprudence. And thirdly, the issue of whether Ofsted was acting fairly and consistently, which is a issue one comes back to, I think, with Ofsted, because it is such a large organisation, obviously inspecting vast numbers of schools, and so there may well be issues of whether schools are treated fairly and consistently as between themselves. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Peter. And now Rachel Cam on set.
I'm going to very quickly take you through six cases on the special educational needs side. There isn't much that's changed over the last year, so most of these cases are going to just be really reaffirming points that are going to be familiar to you, but they're cases that it's quite useful to look at just to see the kinds of points that the upper tribunal's interested in at the moment and where the line is between issues with first-tier tribunal decisions that they will interfere with and ones where they say, well, this isn't an excellent decision, but it's good enough. So the first pair are probably the most legally interesting. These are two decisions by Judge Jacobs in the Upper Tribunal, which both raised questions about the capacity of a young person to litigate. So they were both young people who were over compulsory school age, under the age of 25, and so they now have a right to appeal to the tribunal in their own right, rather than relying on their parents to do it. And in these two cases, there was an issue about whether the young person had the capacity to bring an appeal and to litigate in the tribunal. They were heard together, and the bulk of the two judgments is the same, which sets out a really helpful summary of the capacity issue. So the first of them, which I'll look at in a bit more detail, is the WW case. So William, the young person in that case, was 17. His mother had said, when she put in the appeal in her name, that he didn't have the capacity to litigate, but the local authority thought that he did, or at least that this should be looked at in more detail, and that it should be William who was the proper appellant. The first-tier tribunal registered it in William's name, despite what the mother had said with the information sent in. But then when there was an appeal to the upper tribunal registered the appeal in the mother's name as the appellant, and that was one of the issues that the upper tribunal looked at first. Where we got to with this was that there were going to be three situations which could arise really at any point in the litigation, so it's something to be aware of all the way through. There will be some young people where it's clear that they do have capacity. And remember, when you're looking at capacity, you're looking at capacity to make a particular decision or to take particular steps. So don't do what I just said and say, they've clearly got capacity. You've got to carry on with that sentence and say what they have got capacity to do. So if they have capacity to put in an appeal, to deal with the tribunal, whether that's with somebody else's help or not, just in the same way that any appellant can have a representative to help them in proceedings, if they've got capacity, then they can put in their appeal and be the appellant. If they don't have capacity, then the special educational needs and disability regulations tell you what to do in that situation. So there will be some young people who already have someone who is dealing with their affairs. So there might be a court of protection deputy, there might be a lasting power of attorney or an enduring power of attorney. If one of those people already exists, then under the rules, they are what's called the alternative person, and they can put in the appeal in their name, in their capacity, as the young person's alternative person. If there isn't already somebody in that role, then the regulations say that the alternative person is their parent. So that means the parents have the right to appeal in place of the young person, on behalf of them, in their best interests, and it's that alternative person, the deputy or the parent, who is the named appellant in the proceedings. Then finally, there'll be some cases where it's not clear whether a young person has got capacity to bring the proceedings themselves or not. And if anyone spots that that's an issue, that's something that the tribunal can decide as a preliminary issue, and it's a question of fact. So they would look at what the young person's understanding was of the issues, what they understood about the consequences of an appeal, and all of that kind of thing. Then the final wrinkle is that if the young person is 16 or 17, then as well as the parent potentially being an alternative person under the regulations, they are also, just as the parent, a person with parental responsibility. And so that gives them separate rights as well. So in the WW case, then he was 17, so that was a case where the parent still had parental responsibility. The upper tribunal found that despite what his mother had said when she put in the appeal, in fact, there wasn't the evidence to displace the assumption that William had capacity to bring the proceedings. And so the first tier tribunal had been right to register it in his name. The upper tribunal were wrong to put it in his mother's name. And the judge commented that, in fact, this was a case where William and his parents agreed about what he wanted and what points to put to the tribunal. So, in fact, it wasn't something that was going to make a difference in practice. Then the second of this pair of cases, the SJ case, I'm not going to go into the facts in any detail, but it was another one where you had a young person and where issues were raised during the proceedings about whether he had capacity or not. And that was a case where, in fact, by the time of the upper tribunal hearing, the parties agreed that he didn't have capacity. And so that was a case where it was right that the parents should be down as the formal appellant. There was a separate issue that you might want to look at the SJ judgment about, which was the question of whether the local authority was right to say that there was no need for an EHC plan in his case. This was a young person who had had a statement previously, but the local authority got to the point where they decided that further education for him wouldn't actually gain him another qualification, and that it wasn't necessary for him to remain in education. And this was a young person who was aged 20 by this point. The first tier tribunal had found that that was wrong, that in fact he still could benefit from educational provision and that therapies would help and that it should be delivered in an educational environment. And it wasn't necessary to show that any further education in a plan would lead to him attaining a qualification. So that hopefully that's not too surprising a consequence, that education doesn't have to lead to qualifications. There can be other benefits. And there's a quote on that slide that I won't read out to you now, but you might want to take a moment to read through, that really emphasise that when you're looking at what benefits the young person's going to get, you have to look at what's happening with him in practice, what other support they're getting, and where they could get benefits if it wasn't covered by an education plan. The next case was James's case. I'm hopefully not offending James if I say it doesn't say anything particularly new or particularly surprising, but James was, of course, completely right. As you read through the judgment, it sets out Mr. Gowdy QC's submissions, and they are all correct and all agreed with. So the issue was about the divide between the requirements to provide transport for particular groups of children and young people in the Education Act 96. That's whether or not they've got statements, just the general statutory framework for travel and transport. And on the other hand, what a EHC plan can say about transport. And that was one of the disputes in this case. The starting point is that when you're looking at a child or young person's special educational needs and the special educational provision, transport doesn't come into that. So at that stage, when you're doing part three of your statement or section F of the plan, you're not going to have in there a need for transport to the school. You're just going to look at what they need to have once they get to the school to simplify it. But of course, as you'll know, if you have two possible placements on the table and you get to the tribunal deciding which placement to name, at that point, often there's a comparative exercise when you're looking at the costs of the two placements. And at that point, the cost of the transport to and from each school, if it's necessary, is going to be one of the factors that are taken into account. So transport comes in at that balancing exercise. Where the tribunal had gotten wrong in this case is that they only had one possible placement that could meet the special educational needs, but they still got themselves in a bit of a muddle looking at what transport should be provided when they were looking at what should be in the EHC plan. So that was the mistake that they made there. The tribunal shouldn't have been looking at transport in that way. Once the tribunal had done that, if you're then looking at what the tribunal's jurisdiction was, they do not have the power to look at the right to transport under the 1996 Act. They're just looking at what should be on the face of the plan. However, this is a useful judgment for you to look at if you're looking at those kinds of transport issues, particularly for over 19s, because the upper tribunal went on to look at what the statutory powers and duties were and to spell out when transport does have to be provided to over 19s. The last few cases I'm going to look at, I'm going to take very, very quickly because it's really just flagging up to you that these cases are out there. They don't say anything new, but they are quite helpful if you've got an appeal that raises some of these issues. So the first one, Hertfordshire CC and MC and KC, looks at what a learning difficulty is. So back right at the beginning, if you like, of the thinking about a statement or plan, is this a child with a learning difficulty or disability? And that you're looking at whether they have a significantly greater difficulty in learning or a disability preventing or hindering them from making use of facilities. Again, nothing new here, but it's quite an interesting case to have a look at. On the facts, this child had high-functioning autistic spectrum disorder and behavioural problems. And so if you looked at the progress he was making, the local authority said, well, he doesn't have significantly greater difficulty in learning because look at the results. The local authority only raised this issue on the appeal to the upper tribunal. So in fact, the upper tribunal dealt with it by saying, well, this wasn't a live issue at first-tier tribunal level, so you can't raise it now. So local authorities, if you think there's an issue about whether the child even meets this first hurdle, do raise it at the first opportunity. But the tribunal went on to give some guidance on what the distinction is between learning difficulties and disabilities and how that should be approached. They also looked at the question of when it's necessary for a child to have an EHC plan. And this is something that we'll come back to on the last case that we're looking at. So necessary, somewhere between indispensable and useful. Most children's special educational needs can be met in a mainstream setting from the resources available there. But some are going to need an EHC plan. And I'll come back, as I said, to look at the questions that you have to answer at that stage. Then very briefly, the Devon case was a case where the first tier tribunal really tried to get a Rolls-Royce education for the young person instead of looking at the statutory test of what was reasonably required. I learned a lot about what courses you can take about looking after horses. And I was going to make some kind of joke about horses for courses, but I couldn't quite work it in. So if you're interested in horses and further educational courses available, this is the case for you to look at. If you're not interested in horses, you can probably skip over it. Then a case about the need for statements and, of course, plans to be specific when they set out the special educational provision that's required. Again, nothing new here, but a couple of examples on the slides of the kind of provision that wasn't specific enough. So individual programmes tailored to the child's needs, that's not going to be good enough. And access to multi-sensory teaching might be helpful. Again, that doesn't tell the school or anyone else involved with the child what they actually have to do. So that's not going to be specific enough for a lawful plan. And the final case on the whistle-stop update, SC and MS. This is a really useful decision, actually, to read through if you're looking at what the statutory framework is under the 1996 Act, for deciding whether you need to assess, and then once you have assessed, deciding whether you need to make a statement in respect of a particular child. There's a very detailed analysis of the statutory framework, which takes you through step by step, so I do recommend having a look at the decision for that reason, if not for any other. It also really fits into that framework the question of what you do if there's a child who in fact isn't in a mainstream school at the time you're deciding whether or not an assessment is required. So the test that the Upper Tribunal has set out previously is that you're looking at whether a maintained mainstream school could reasonably be expected to make the special educational provision that's called for from within its resources. And if you are looking at a child who isn't in a maintained mainstream school at the time, perhaps because the parents are home educating them or they're in an independent school whilst the issue is resolved, it can be difficult to get together the evidence to show what a maintained mainstream school would be able to do and what resources they already have, because you're looking at it really in the abstract. The not particularly helpful answer is to apply that test pragmatically. Good luck with that. So the tribunal has recognised that if there isn't a school placement, it's going to be harder to get the evidence together, but it is still that same question of looking at what a maintained mainstream school could reasonably provide and what resources and facilities there'll be. So as the local authority, you'd need to look at that in general terms and get together as much evidence as you could on that question.